the Journal, which someone passed on to me. I don't remember which issue it was, September, October of 99, somewhere around the fall. Now, that was probably only the second or third issue I've ever seen of the Journal. I'm going to start subscribing to it because it really opened my eyes to what's going on in the Church of God. 137 organizations were listed as all the churches. They were all listed with their addresses. 137 that we know of. Looking over this whole page of different organizations really scared me. It really sunk in. Turn to the 10th chapter of Jeremiah, verse 20. Jeremiah 10, verse 20. My tabernacle is spoiled, and all my cords are broken. My children are gone forth of me, and they are not. There is none to stretch forth my tent anymore, and to set up my curtains. God says, my tabernacle is spoiled, and all my cords are broken. The cords hold a tent, and we all know what happens to a tent when you cut the cords. God goes on to say, there is none to stretch forth my tent anymore and to set up my curtains. Brethren, this is the same as saying God's people are not holding fast to the house. Verse 21, for the pastors are become brutish and have not sought the Lord, therefore they shall not prosper, and all their flocks shall be scattered. 137 known organizations, not to mention all the brethren, brutalized by the shepherds that just sit at home. Are we in trouble? Are the ministry in trouble? Jeremiah 23, verse 1. That's Jeremiah 23, verse 1. Woe be unto the pastors that destroy and scatter the sheep of my pasture, saith the Lord. Let's turn to Ezekiel 34, verse 2. It's a scary thought when you read all that in the Journal. People are all undecided. This is all happening in the Church of God. Ezekiel 34, verse 2. Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say unto them, thus saith the Lord God unto the shepherds. Woe be to the shepherds of Israel that do feed themselves. Should not the shepherds feed the flocks? You eat the fat, and you clothe you with the wool. You kill them that are fed, but you feed not the flock. The diseased have you not strengthened, neither have you healed that which was sick, neither have you bound that which was broken, neither have you brought again that which was driven away, neither have you sought that which was lost, but with force and with cruelty have you ruled them. Does this sound brutish? I'd say that you can call it that. Verse 5, and they have scattered because there is no shepherd, and they became meat to all the beasts of the field, and they were scattered. My sheep wandered through all the mountains, upon every high hill. Yeah, my flock was scattered upon all the face of the earth, and none did search or seek after them. Verse 7, therefore, ye shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. As I live, saith the Lord God, surely because my flock became a prey, and my flock became meat to every beast of the field, because there was no shepherd, neither did my shepherd search for my flock, but the shepherds fed themselves, and fed not my flock. Therefore, O ye shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am against the shepherds, and I will require my flock at their hand, and cause them to cease from feeding the flock. Neither shall the shepherds feed themselves any more, for I will deliver my flock from their mouth, that they may not be meat for them. For thus saith the Lord God, behold, I, even I, will both search my sheep and seek them out. That is a big message for the ministry, the brethren. Whether we be ministers or not, we are all in big trouble. Now, The seventh era, Laodicea, we have been told recently, means the people judge or the people decide. Are we immune from doing this? Have we had to make decisions? It used to be that the ministry were to make sound judgments and decisions for the sheep, then the sheep would have to act on the judgment in order to do the right. Malachi 2, verse 1. Something we're familiar with. Malachi 2, verse 1. And now, O ye priests, this commandment is for you. God says this message is directed for the ministry. So good, verse 7. For the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. They should be looking to God and the word of God for the law, but they do not. Verse 8. But you are departed out of the way. You have caused many to stumble at the law. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi, saith the Lord of hosts. Why have the ministry corrupted the covenant, and why have they caused many to stumble at the law? Malachi 4:4. The answer is right here for anyone who wants to open their eyes and see. Remember. That's the key word. Remember you the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb, for all Israel, with the statutes and judgments. God's church cannot or will not remember the statutes and judgments God gave us from the one who restored all things in his end time. The debates and articles written in the journal show exactly that. Disputes over tithing, is there tithing, isn't there tithing? Disputes over this doctrine or that doctrine, what they said, what he said, it goes on and on. What's the key here, brethren? We need to remember the law. I asked earlier if we were immune from making a decision or judgments. The answer to that question is absolutely not. However, keep this in mind. We had better not make that decision or judgment by ourselves, or we are in big trouble. Brethren, we are bought with a price. Let's turn to Philippians 2:5. Philippians 2:5. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. Brethren, the only way we can make a judgment or decision is applying God's law and making sure we are using the mind of God. We must make sure we are using the mind of God that God has given us by His Holy Spirit. There may be 137 different organizations, but there is only one God, and we are going to have to give an account. So let's remember.
Okay. Just a couple of little announcements here. This is something of interest here. December 22nd is the winter solstice, also called the first day of winter. But there's going to be a full moon on that day. That doesn't happen very often, and it's going to be the moon will appear about 14% larger than it does at any other time, or the small time when it's the smallest. So, on the average, it'll be about 7% stronger, making it about 7% brighter. Then it is said it's going to be so light that you can really actually almost be like daylight, like dusk. It's going to be a lot lighter. So that would be, December the, what's today? 22nd is on Wednesday, I believe, isn't it? Is it 23rd? Wednesday, yes, Wednesday. So this Wednesday, if you have a clear sky, if we do here, it might be good to go out and look at that full moon and just see it's a lot bigger than normal. And so it's just one of those occurrences that happen very often. We certainly don't want to howl at the moon or anything, but it's just one of those phenomena that happens every now and then. So it'll be interesting to see that. Hopefully we'll have clear skies. They're predicting clear skies here, except for the fog occasionally. So maybe we can see above the fog. Yeah. If it's bright enough, it'll be pretty bright outside. Did get a call from the Philippines this week from one of the fellows over there that does want to continue on the tape list, and that's two of them now that want to be on the tape list. I've got a letter ready to send out to the Philippines, but I'm not going to do it till after the first of the year, because the Christmas problems over there. The mail is all tied up, and so after Christmas time, now all the mailing will be gone. Then it will be easier, and it should get out just about the same amount of time. If I mailed it now and sent it out, or last week, if I'd have sent it out last week when I had it done, it wouldn't have gotten there any sooner than if I would have mailed it after the Christmas holidays. So it's going to end up about the same. And we know what that's like if you've been standing at the post office trying to mail something this week. Boy, there's people mail a lot of things out there, a lot of cards. Uncle Sam makes a lot of money about this time of year for mailing. But anyway, this fellow said that some of the people that were with us there, or in Restored even, have decided just to kind of sit back and take a look-and-see situation right now. And I said, that's the best way to do it. Evaluate everything that's going on and check it all out. So they're getting different tapes from different people, different groups, and checking it out. And they do want the tapes that we send out from here. And so we're going to continue to do that for them. And then that letter will get out to those others that are in the outlying areas, or that they don't get to hear the news as much. And they're really starving for that. And I don't know whether they're getting tape from anybody else in those other outside areas or not. But I will be writing them a letter and asking them if they do want the tapes from here, then they'll have to respond. If they don't, then we won't be sending the tapes out. And that's, we'll see how it goes from there. There was a lot of people over there, but, you know, this whole situation has kind of filtered out some attitudes and some that didn't have enough faith. It's one of those cleansing processes, I guess, of the church, or filtering processes to see who's really going to stay the course, who's going to really hold fast to the truth. And, of course, those who do are going to eventually be together. We know that. It's a matter of time. Not anybody's looking for a following year. It's just the fact that God will put us together so we can speak the same things. Truth is truth. So we know what's all happened there, and it'll get out. Truth will prevail in the long run. We know that. That's faith in God, and we know that He's in charge, and Christ is the head of the church, and He knows exactly what's going on at all times. Can't fool Him, can't get around Him, so we might as well agree with Him. That's what I tell everybody. You should just agree with Him, and then you don't have to worry about it. And believe it. Well, here's a booklet I've got. It's on Bible trivia, but there was something in here. I heard this on the TV here not too long ago, probably a few months ago, and it was a little saying that somebody had. It shows how people can get so mixed up because they don't understand the Bible, or they take little bits and here and there and put it together. And you'll see by when I read this that it's quite humorous. It just shows how people can get all mixed up. So I'm going to read this to you. The Book of Parables. What's the title of this? The Book of Parables. Recently I interviewed you can put student, teacher, or whoever in there. I could put in there teachers, I suppose, from some name of a church or school organization, and ask him or her some Bible questions. I could tell that they had really learned a great deal. So I asked them what their favorite book of the Bible was. They said, the New Testament. I replied, what part of the New Testament? Oh, by far, I love the Book of Parables best. I said, would you kind of relate one of those parables to me? And they said, once upon a time, a man went from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves. And the thieves threw him into the weeds. And the weeds grew up and choked that man. And he went on and met the Queen of Sheba, and she gave that man 1,000 talents of gold and silver and 100 chains of raiment. He then got into his chariot and drove furiously toward the Red Sea. When he got there, the waters parted, and he drove to the other side. On the other side, he drove under a big olive tree and got his hair caught on a limb and was left hanging there. He hung there many days and many nights, and the ravens brought him food to eat and water to drink. One night, while he was hanging there asleep, his wife Delilah came along and cut off his hair. And he dropped and fell on stony ground. And the children of the nearby city came out and said, go you up, thou bald head, go you up, thou bald head. And the man cursed the children, and 2 she-bears came out of the woods and tore the children. Then it began to rain, and it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. And he went and hid himself in a cave. Later he went out and met a man and said, come and suffer with me. But the man replied, I cannot come, for I have married a wife. So he went out into the highways and byways and compelled them to come in, but they would not heed his call. He then went on to Jericho and blew his trumpet 7 times, and the city walls came tumbling down. And as he walked by one of the damaged buildings in the city, he saw Queen Jezebel sitting high up in a window. And when she saw him, she laughed and made fun of him. The man grew furious and said, "Toss her down." They did. And he said, "Toss her down again." And they did. And they threw her down 70 times 7. And the fragments they gathered up were 12 baskets full. The question now is, whose wife will she be on the day of resurrection? I thought that was quite humorous. Shows how people can get so mixed up. Okay, before we have the sermon now, we're going to have another song, but the sermon will be a continuation of the healing. This is part 2 by Mr. Richard Duncan from 1980. And this is a not completed sermon, I am sorry to say. I got the tape, and these are tapes were given to me, and when I got to the end of the second part, there's about maybe 7 minutes missing or something like that when he got into the benefits of physical fasting, the physical benefits of fasting. He gets into a little bit, he mentions a little bit about the spiritual, just starts to get into it, and then into the tape. So we'll have to stop it there, but I can tell you, I heard the sermon by him, and it was about how you can go on a juice fast or on a pure, just a plain fast or water fast and purify your body, purify your blood, get rid of the toxins and the poisons, and that's what he got into. And I think we know pretty much that, but that subject can be covered again sometime, maybe even in a sermonette on fasting, on just the physical benefits of fasting, or on a sermon on good health again down the line. We'll get into that. But anyway, it'll stop abruptly. You'll say, "Well, what happened? I wish it could have continued, but it's not there. I don't have it, and I can't go back and pick it up anywhere. I don't know anybody else has this tape. It was just given to me by some friends, and I've had it for quite a long time." So, after the song now, we'll have, all stand please, and we'll have the sermon after that.
Wait till the bitter patter of little feet die down a minute, I guess, a minute or two. About 3 weeks ago, we talked about healing. Healing God's way as opposed to man's way, the way of the idolatrous religion of modern medicine, as Dr. Robert Mendelson calls what he feels is very superfluous and unneeded medical practice today. Of course, he is the author of the book, Confessions of a Medical Heretic. In his book, Confessions of a Medical Heretic, Dr. Mendelson also spends a little time talking about health, though that's not the primary thrust of the book. And he talks about health as opposed to the philosophy of modern medicine and their philosophy toward health. And of course, there's a common sense approach toward health as well. Now, the world wouldn't need nearly so many doctors, and we wouldn't need to worry about healing nearly so much if we went to work on eliminating from our lives what causes sickness and disease. Now, I was really impressed not only with Dr. Mendelson's book, but with his overall philosophy in regard to health, as well as avoiding the dangers of modern medicine. In many areas, his viewpoint that he expresses in his book is very similar to what our belief has been in regard to medicine and health. Now, today I want to focus on health. Isn't it far better to maintain good health and prevent disease in the first place, rather than to become sick and have to rely on medicine or healing from God in the second place, should we become ill? Now, I'm not belittling healing or not putting healing down. I don't mean that. If God did not foresee that we would need or that we would become ill sometimes, then he wouldn't have made provisions for our healing, as we went through last time, about 3 weeks ago. Anyway, open up your Bibles to 3 John, verse 2. God's Word also illustrates or has instructions in it in regard to health principles that will help us, if we follow them, prevent sickness and disease. Now, 3 John, verse 2, expresses God's will and God's desire for us in this particular field. And it says here in verse 2, 3 John, he said, "Dear friend, I pray that you may enjoy good health, and that all may go well with you, even as your soul is getting along well," as the New International Version translates that. So God's will for us is that we enjoy good health. It isn't God's will or intention for us to be sick, even though he knew that sometimes we would be. Now, there are laws that regulate health. There is a cause and effect for all things. Mr. Armstrong, some of the things that he's written in regard to health, explained that there, of course, are physical laws that deal with health, and it is a physical sin to break some of these laws, and that the consequences of physical sin is sickness and disease. Now, as we read in the Bible, Matthew chapter 9, first few verses of Matthew chapter 9 last time, in that sermon on healing, we saw that Jesus Christ at times healed the sick by forgiving their sins. Now, modern medicine's approach to sickness and disease is only to deal with the effect, only to deal with the symptoms, not the cause. Now, in the United States today, it's interesting, there is a growing concern for health. More books are being written, more people, you might say, are being converted to the view of preventing disease rather than trying to deal with it once you have it. There was one such person on the talk show on KEX last Wednesday night, a man named Carl Mendel, who wrote the Vitamin Bible. And he talks about nutrition and that type of thing. Now, Carl Mendel is a pharmacist and a nutritionalist. His views are almost identical to Dr. Mendelsohn's in regard to the dangers of drugs in modern medicine. He stated that drugs and the like only deal with the effect on that particular program last Wednesday night, not the cause of disease. Drugs cannot remove disease because they don't deal with the cause of it. They're only trying to do away with the symptoms. They're not getting down to what's causing it in the first place. Now, Dr. Mendelsohn says in his book here, Confessions of a Medical Heretic, in regard to modern medicine's approach to sickness and disease, he says on page 220, and he says in regard to modern medicine, he said, "There's no way anybody can justify the billions of dollars we spend every year on health care, because we're not getting healthier. As the bill gets higher, we're getting sicker. Spend more money, but it's all spent in regard to dealing with the symptom, dealing with the effect, not the cause." And as he goes on to say here, modern medicine has succeeded in teaching us to equate medical care with health. It is that equation which has the potential to destroy our bodies, our families, our communities, and our world. Now, he says modern medicine's approach to health has a potential to destroy our bodies, families, communities, and our world. Destroy, not save us. Now, why does he say that anyway? Because of modern medicine, for the most part, the part that he takes exception to, and the world's approach to health is backwards. And that's why he says that. Now, he goes on about and talks about this further on pages 240 and 241. He said, "If a doctor practices real preventive medicine, his patients are going to be healthier and will therefore require fewer visits to his office." You can see right away that this is contrary as you can get to modern medicine's idea. That's not what they're after in that particular case. Modern medicine is not interested in really preventing disease, because that would, of course, cut out its own existence. In fact, there is only one medical school in North America that requires its medical students to take a course in nutrition. And that school is in Toronto, Canada, not even in the United States, where nutrition is a required course. As he mentioned, doctors know nothing about nutrition. They're not taught it, not emphasized, has nothing to do with their practice of medicine for the most part. And then he goes on to describe modern medicine's philosophy in regard to disease. He says on this same page, he said, one of the mechanisms doctors use is the blame the victim game. It's your fault if you're sick. Not because of disease-producing habits you developed and refused to exchange for health-producing ones. They don't tell you that. They don't tell you that you did something that caused you to be sick. That's not their approach. They don't deal with the cause. But you're sick because you didn't receive the sacraments of modern medicine soon enough, or at all. Didn't get their holy waters, as he calls them, in that regard. And so he says, if you believe in modern medicine, you believe that you really never can expect health. You never really know what to expect, since disease is a random process. In other words, it just happens to you, something that comes up and stabs you in the back, and you're innocent, and didn't do anything, didn't have anything you've done had nothing to do with whether you're sick or well, or that type of thing. That you live in a neurotic state of tension and fear and guilt, anesthetized against your responsibilities and powers. In other words, they don't encourage you at all to look after your health apart from their methods. Modern medicine does not teach that broken health laws cause sickness. They teach you are sick because you didn't take enough of their immunizations, their drugs, their procedures, and they promote fear of disease in order to keep people in their clutches. Dr. Mendelsohn talks about the dangers of immunizations, including things that I had never heard before. Things like arthritis being a result of immunizations, multiple sclerosis being a result of immunizations, encephalitis, Parkinson's disease. When you get older, these type of things. And, of course, you heard not too long ago in the great swine flu immunization program, the Guillain-Barré syndrome, where many people got meningitis from taking the immunization against swine flu. And as he explains in his book, that's all a waste of time anyway, because the particular strain of flu that the immunization is made to try to prevent is the one that was last year. It's not the one that's coming this year. It's a different strain. It has no effect on it. So you're just wasting your time. But in one of his tapes, the one we'll have available here in the library, Dr. Mendelsohn says if people ate natural foods, they would develop natural immunities. He even talks about the polio vaccine. He said that in the past 12 years, two-thirds of all of the polio cases in this country have been the result of or have been associated with the polio vaccine. Two-thirds. He says, Dr. Salk says Dr. Sabin's polio vaccine is no good. He says, Dr. Sabin says Dr. Salk's polio vaccine is no good. And he says, you know what? They're both right. He talks about the natural immunizations, too. And breastfed babies is where that begins, in which the mother's immunizations, all of her immunizations, are passed on to the baby. Modern medicine subtly teaches that sickness and disease are inevitable, they're unpreventable. How you live really doesn't have any bearing on whether you get sick or not. In other words, the laws of health and nutrition are done away. You can break the laws and we'll make it right. We'll fix you up with their drugs, with their shots, with their tranquilizers, with an operation or what have you. You break the laws and we'll take care of the consequences for you. You know, that's Satan's approach to God and Satan's philosophy that you can break the laws and escape the penalty. No, you can't. And that's what Dr. Mendelsohn says. You can't. And if that were true, you can break the laws and escape the penalty, then there would be no need for doctors, no medicines, no operations, no need for healing. That's not true. Now, we in the church take health too lightly. We didn't used to do that. You know, I can remember when it used to be virtually a sin to have white sugar or white flour in your home, as far as the church was concerned. Virtually a sin. We used to be much more health conscious in the church than we are now. But we've apparently been affected by the end is near syndrome. It's had its effect. Christ is going to return soon, so I don't have to take care of myself. Or I'll last, you know, a few more years till he comes back, get a new body. Don't have to be that careful about this one, that type of thing. Now, 1 Corinthians 6, verses 19 and 20, talk about that in principle. Does God condone being careless with our health? Maybe another thing that causes us to disregard caring for our health is the fact that God heals. So we tend to think, well, if I do get sick, I can be prayed for and healed, and maybe we use that as an excuse to be careless. Now, in such cases, maybe God will wait until we learn a lesson before he heals us. God says here in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 19 and 20, he said, "Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you received from God? You are not your own. You were bought by a price. Therefore, glorify or honor God with or in your body." Now, the church is God's temple. We, as members, who God's Spirit is dwelling in, are part of that temple. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 16 and 17 says, I'll just turn over and read that. It said, "Don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple, and that God's Spirit lives in you or dwells in you? If anyone defiles or destroys God's temple, God will destroy him. For God's temple is sacred, and you are that temple." So this is talking about the fact that God intends for us to obey and live by his physical laws of health that God has set in motion, as well as his spiritual laws. Because how effective we are spiritually is based in part on how healthy, how well, how strong, energetic, so on we are physically, too. Now, Dr. Mendelsohn explains his philosophy in this regard on page 260 of his book. And he says, in regard to health, said, "Your first responsibility is to take care of your body and mind. Food is very important, but not food merely in the sense of bread, water, protein, fiber, and vitamins. You must try to eat pure food and drink pure water. You must find out all you can about which foods are best for you, since what goes into your mouth does make a difference in what comes out. In a sense, everything that comes into your life and body is food, whether it's nourishing or whether it's junk food, is the individual's responsibility, in order to determine, to know, to understand, and will determine the self-success in reaching the goal of health." He knows that what determines for the most part whether we're healthy or not depends on what we eat and what we drink and what we breathe. He doesn't go into nutrition in detail in his book. That's not the purpose of his book. You have to learn, he said, what is good and pure and wholesome food and water and what isn't. And pure means unadulterated and unrefined, living, not embalmed food things. Not embalmed by the nitrates and the nitrates and the nitrites and all the other ites and preservatives and junk that they put in food and processed food today. And he goes on to say, in page 261, he said, "If you believe in modern medicine, you believe that you never really can expect health. You never really know what to expect, since disease is a random process and you live in that state of tension, fear, guilt, anesthetized against your responsibilities and powers." In other words, to regulate your own health. Now, this is basically what we read in 3 John 2. God wishes that we live healthy and happy and long lives. Now, besides the pure water, Dr. Mendelsohn talks about physical and mental exercise. He says, if you spend a lot of time in front of the television, lost in a make-believe world that runs a poor second to real life, you're wasting the time of your life, time that should be used to nourish yourself and those around you. Choose your food. Try to taste and see and hear and smell and touch things that will add to your supply of life. Our new medicine consecrates activities as well as food. Now, he is in the process of establishing a medical school that will teach the philosophy that he and other doctors have in regard to health and medicine. He says the consecration of activity governs what the individual does with the body and with the mind, the muscles, and the spirit. He's talking about physical and mental and spiritual exercise. All religions have some form of vocation, but the calling from God is usually reserved for those who are going to enter the religion's priesthood. Read 1 Peter 2:9 about our calling in that regard, and that we are called to be a royal priesthood. Our new medicine says that everyone should choose his or her career as if called by God, because in a very real way, everyone does have a vocation. Everyone is called to live a long and happy life. And that's true. And that's what God says. His intent and desire is for us. Now, Dr. Mendelsohn, religiously, is a practicing Orthodox Jew. I didn't know that until I listened to the tape, and it mentions that on the tape, that he does not go out and lecture on the Sabbath. He's very, you know, very strict as far as his belief of the Sabbath is concerned. Of course, along with that would go keeping God's health laws, and of course they have some added health laws of their own that they follow besides. But let's go on to look at some of the biblical laws and principles of health. First, turn to Proverbs chapter 17, verse 22. First law of good health is to maintain a tranquil and peaceful mind. Now, we really covered that law in a sermon a couple of months ago about the mind of Christ. That the mind, the attitude, the frame of mind, the thoughts of the mind has one of the biggest impacts on our health of any single area of life. Proverbs 17:22, we read that before. We'll read it again. It said, a cheerful heart does good like a medicine, but a crushed spirit dries up the bones. An upset, a confused, a fear-filled, a negative, critical, fault-finding, unhappy, worrying mind causes all kinds of ills of the body, including ulcers, indigestion, hypertension, high blood pressure, heart problems, headaches, eye strain, nervousness, and on and on and on you could go. Just the mental state of mind being in a negative state. And this is a biblical principle. The positive state does good like a medicine. The negative state of mind, the mind that is not tranquil, not peaceful, tears apart the body. I turn back to Proverbs 15. Several proverbs shed light in this particular area of maintaining a tranquil, peaceful state of mind. Several right here in Proverbs chapter 15, verse 1. It says, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. And of course, anger, wrath, hostility, resentment are negative emotions that also tear down the whole, the health. Note verse 4. The tongue that brings healing is a tree of life, but a deceitful tongue crushes the spirit. Gentle words, kind words, inspiring words, uplifting words, praise and encouragement, which spring, of course, from the right attitude, the right mind, the right heart, bring healing. And they're like a tree of life, and they add both quality and quantity to life. They upgrade life and they add length of life both to the giver of those kind of words and thoughts and to the one that receives them. Talking about a positive versus negative effect or frame of mind. I'm dropping down to verse 13. As we read before, a happy heart makes the face cheerful, but heartache crushes the spirit. And this just goes on, reinforces the fact that the negative, unhappy, upset, turmoil-filled mind crushes the spirit and tears down both mental and physical health. And I keep preaching and preaching on this, and I still hear of people who get all upset emotionally. I hear of family upsets. I hear of people saying unkind things to other people. And I wonder, what in the world do I have to do? How can I get these things across? I'm doing the best I can. I keep, you know, bang, 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 bang away at these things. And what these things are written for our benefit, for us to profit from. In many, many ways, they're to our advantage to apply these laws and principles of God. Anyway, he goes on in verse 17. He said, better a meal of vegetables where there is love than a fatted calf with hatred. In other words, you can just have kind of a skimpy meal, but if it's pleasant, happy, there's love there, that is far better than a banquet where there is, you know, anger, resentment, turmoil, that type of thing. That type of thing just causes your body to just knot up and actually stops the digestion of food, which adds to physical illnesses as well as family problems. That type of thing. Drugs and alcohol and tranquilizers are not the answer to those things. They don't remove the cause of mental upset and turmoil. Kind of interesting. Last Wednesday evening on KEX, a woman called in on that talk show and asked Carl Mandel if a tranquilizer she was taking would be harmful to her, because he was discussing, you know, some of the harmful side effects, various drugs, tranquilizers, and that type of thing. And he said, well, why are you taking this tranquilizer? And she says, well, she says, my nerves are shot. You know, they're just, I'm just all strung out and I'm all uptight and so on, and my neighbor just bugs me something awful. You know, it's my neighbor's fault that I have to take this tranquilizer. Well, he says, well, why in the world don't you do something about that? Why don't you move? Why don't you get the neighbor to move? No, get rid of the cause of the problem. Why don't you do that? And she wouldn't do that. She couldn't hear, oh, I can't do that. And he used that as an example of the fact that people don't want to deal with the cause of their problems. Only the effect. Give me something to make the symptom or the effect go away. Human nature doesn't want to get down to the root of the problems and remove the cause. It wants a ready-made solution, a pill, a drug, you know, a shot, whatever it is, to make the symptoms go away. It doesn't want to get down and straighten out what's wrong. A person's attitude, approach, in this case, or whatever. God's way is to do away with the cause of the problem. Put sin out of our lives, in other words. Straighten up our attitude. Change how we react to things. Get on a positive frame of mind rather than the negative. He goes on, verse 30 in this particular chapter. A cheerful look brings joy to the heart, and good news gives health to the bones. Cheerful look, good news, pleasant sights, good reports, whatsoever is good and lovely and pure and noble and true and right and admirable and praiseworthy. Think on these things, says Philippians 4:8. The happy, tranquil, peace, and faith-filled mind is probably the greatest source of good health of any one of God's health laws. The major one. Because many doctors have written that up to 90% of the physical ailments that we have started originally with the mind, with upset emotions. Negative frame of mind. Fear, turmoil, stress, that type of thing. So let's try to live up to that one. You know, it doesn't cost anything. You don't have to go down and buy a pill for it. All we have to do is practice the principles to maintaining a positive attitude that are outlined in the scriptures. Right, let's go on to the next basic health law. Leviticus 7, verses 22 through 27. Second and most important law of health is to eat, as we read from Dr. Mendelsohn's book here, to eat pure, proper food. Now, the Bible says more about what we shouldn't eat that is impure and improper than possibly about what it says we ought to eat. No man has been able to discover what is good for the body as far as nutrition overall. In the areas where man, of and by himself, couldn't determine what is good and what is not good, God has given some basic instructions. And primarily, they have to do with what we shouldn't eat. Now, in this particular regard, Leviticus chapter 7, beginning in verse 22. He said, The Lord said to Moses, say to the Israelites, do not eat any of the fat of cattle or sheep or goats. Now, notice the emphasis is put on the fat of animals. He doesn't mention the fat of fowl. Now, fowl fat is not as foul as the fat of animals, apparently. There is a difference between chicken fat and beef fat. Though I don't advocate, you know, going out and eating chicken fat or turkey fat or whatever it might be in that particular area. But the emphasis really is put on animal fat in this particular context. Verse 24, the fat of an animal found dead or torn by wild animals may be used for any other purpose, but you must not eat it. Now, of course, fat is used for soap. Fat was used for lubricants, for axle grease and that type of thing. Had other purposes other than eating it. And it goes on, anyone who eats the fat of an animal from which an offering by fire may be made, of course now only clean animals were the ones that were offered. Anyone who eats the fat of an animal from which an offering by fire may be made to the Lord must be cut off from his people. So here he's talking about not eating fat. Now Dr. Paul Dudley White, who was a very famous heart disease specialist, he's the doctor who treated ex-president or past president Eisenhower, once quoted these verses. He quoted what we've just read. And he said, it is conceivable that a few years from now, we medical men may repeat to the citizens of the United States the advice Moses was asked by God to present to the children of Israel over 3,000 years ago. Why did he say that? Why does God say don't eat fat? Now, medical science has proved that there is a correlation between heart disease, the number one killer in the United States, and diet, especially diet high in animal fat, because of the cholesterol. Animal fats are high in cholesterol, which plug the arteries, which lead to heart attack, various kinds of heart disease. And of the animals that God says are fit to eat, beef is the worst, or the one that's highest in fat, as far as its flesh is concerned, and especially the way that we raise and market beef today, because they really fatten them up today. No, the good old regular hamburger that you and I live on, because we can't buy roast and can't buy the steaks and that type of thing, that regular old hamburger that you buy is 30% fat. Look on the label. Almost one-third artery-plugging fat in that hamburger. Now, the leanest and the highest-priced hamburger is still around 16%. And if you buy that, you just as well buy roast, because roast is just cheap. When you get to the good, you know, the hamburger that's up in maybe the more or less edible range as far as the fat content is concerned. Now, the Japanese people eat very little beef, and they have very little heart disease. They don't suffer from heart disease like we do. Now, they're importing more of our beef, so no doubt their heart disease rate will go up, too. But up until recent times, they have not had heart disease like we do, because they don't eat fat like we do. And I'm convinced that the Israelites ate more goat and ate more sheep and veal than they did beef anyway. So the smaller animals in those days. They couldn't can it. They couldn't freeze it. They might be able to salt it, which, of course, the salt tired on you then. But they had to eat most of it before it spoiled. So they would slaughter the smaller animals for some of the big beasts. When there would be enough people, you know, gathered in one place, they could kill the ox and roast the ox, and they could consume that particular ox in a short period of time. Now notice verse 16, 17, and 18 here. Verse 16. And this is another reason I feel that they ate only small animals. If, however, his offering, talking about offerings that are made, is the result of a vow or a free will offering, the sacrifice, of course, there were some offerings that the people participated in eating themselves. The sacrifice shall be eaten on the day he offers it, but anything left over may be eaten on the next day. Any meat of the sacrifice left over till the third day must be burned up. If any meat of the fellowship or peace offering is eaten on the third day, it will not be accepted. It will not be credited to the one who offered it, for it is impure. The person who eats any of it will be held responsible. Those particular offerings that the priest and the offerers also ate part of had to be eaten within 2 days of it being killed or slaughtered. So they weren't going to wait, you know, slaughter the big animals and throw away most of them. Besides that, to use the ox plow with, drag the cart around with, that type of thing. Now, the Bible doesn't say this applied to animals that were slaughtered and eaten, you know, that were not offered in sacrifices, as far as I know. But the Israelites ate what they slaughtered shortly after killing it. So they probably didn't eat much beef to start with. They had a lot of goats, you know, and goat meat is very lean to begin with. Sheep is a little bit fatter, but range-run ones aren't nearly as fat as beef. And besides, when the Israelites ate any meat, God said, you don't eat that fat. They cut off all of the extra fat and threw it away, or they burned it as part of the offering. That was God's food. You know, that pictured the good. That pictured the blessing, the fat of the land, so to speak. So it was offered to God. Also, it's not fit to eat as far as health is concerned. Now, what do we do with the fat? We mix it in with a hamburger, hot dog, and bologna, you know, up to 30%, that type of thing. And we wonder why we as Americans are dying off with heart disease. Right? Verse 26 and 27. He goes on to say here, he said, and wherever you live, you must not eat the blood of any bird or animal. If anyone eats blood, that person must be cut off from his people. For every living in this particular case, every living creature that was fit for food had to be properly bled before being eaten. Now, many of the Gentiles in those days didn't do that. They even ate of the blood as a religious rite in honor of some false god that they had sacrificed the creature to. Now, today, animals are bled when they're slaughtered adequately, except maybe some modern poultry butchering methods don't do as good a job as they should. They leave more blood in the flesh than they should, really. Now, people did eat, still do eat, blood. Pudding, blood, coffee, sound good? And I was in Peel's right over here on 70, right over here, you know, off of Andreessen the other day. Looked in the meat counter, and there they had a big old chunk of blood sausage for sale in there. But people still eat that stuff. But God says, don't do that. Don't eat the blood, don't eat the fat. And there are reasons why he says that. Because of the toxins and so on in the blood, as well as the fact that blood is the symbol of life and has to be poured out on the ground. Now, Deuteronomy 14, verses 2 through 21, God gives instructions of what are clean and unclean creatures and thus fit or unfit to eat. I think we're all familiar with these particular scriptures. Leviticus 11 is a corresponding chapter, says virtually the same thing. Beginning in verse 2, though, he says, that for you are a people holy to the Lord your God. Out of all the peoples on the face of the earth, the Lord has chosen you to be his treasured possession. This is somewhat similar to 1 Corinthians 3:17, 1 Corinthians 6:20, that we are God's temple. We're to glorify God in our bodies.
And so in regard to this, God goes on to say, verse 3, do not eat any detestable thing. These are the animals you may eat, the ox or the beef, the sheep, the goat, the deer, the gazelle, the roe deer, the wild goat, the ibex, the antelope, and the mountain sheep. You may eat any animal that has a split hoof, divided in two, and that chews the cud. Of course, animals that chew the cud are called ruminants. That is, they have a multi-compartment stomach. They eat the food that goes in down in the first compartment. It gets all rolled up in a ball. It's fermented, digested partly, regurgitated. They chew on it some more, and then it goes down in the other sections of the stomach, and so on. Of deer, elk, moose, mountain sheep, mountain goat, antelope, buffaloes, as well as cows, sheep, and goat are all ruminant type of animals. Well, the Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary mentions some interesting observations. It says that these cud-chewing animals, in the process of chewing their cud, this digestive process, removed large portions of any poisonous material that may be in any of the plants or the noxious plants that they may eat. It's a process where the toxins are removed out of the vegetable matter that they eat. And it doesn't go in their flesh. And they point out that this is especially true for cows and goats who throw off the most of this toxic material. Now, those animals' digestive systems were created to remove anything that might be harmful for us so that it's fit for us to eat. But it goes on here in verse 7 and 8, the same thing. Said, however, of those that chew the cud or that have a split hoof completely divided, you may not eat the camel, the rabbit, or the cooney. That was a rock badger, a rodent-like animal that lived in the Mideast, about the size of a rabbit. Although they chew the cud, they do not have a split hoof. They are ceremonially unclean for you. The pig is also unclean. Although it has a split hoof, it does not chew the cud. You are not to eat their meat or touch their carcasses. So God says, not only don't eat them, he says, don't even touch them. And as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary says, and they quote from Whitlaw's Code of Health, that animals such as the pig and the camel, which do not chew the cud, convert their food less perfectly than, of course, the cud chewers, and their flesh is therefore unwholesome from, as the way they put it, from the gross animal juices with which they abound. And they mention that some of these animals, like the pig, have this sewer system in their flesh, that there's a system of vessels that empty behind the dew claw in their lower legs, in which the toxins and so on drain out of their flesh. Of course, all that stuff is mixed in with their flesh, too. But he said, then they go on to say that these animals are apt to produce scrofulous disorders. That are disorders like ulcers and boils and various kinds of inflammation. And they said, in relation to the pig or swine, eating its flesh, especially in hot climates, is likely to produce, besides boils and eruptions, also leprosy. That's more true in hot than cold climates. Now, a year or so ago, the Columbian here ran an article that said doctors in the southern area of the United States, Texas and Louisiana especially, felt that people were contracting leprosy because they were eating armadillos down there. You know what the little armadillo is. And they have more leprosy in the south, in the southern part of the United States, than we do here. And those people eat more pigs and garbage animals like possums and raccoons and squirrels and armadillos and so on. And they also point out the fact that pigs carry many parasites, including trichinosis, which infect human beings. Some parasites in pigs can withstand temperatures of up to 600 degrees Fahrenheit before they're killed. So cooking often doesn't kill them at all. You get those little goodies in you when you eat that stuff. Unclean animals are just living garbage disposals in compost makers. But God created them for it. They aren't fit to eat. God didn't make them to be fit to eat. So he says, don't eat them. you do, then you're opening yourself up to disease. So there was here recently down in California a couple of young people out, you know, on a survival hike. They shot a young bear, ate the bear, came down with trichinosis. The bears also carry that. A number of other animals, too, that are not edible. Verse 9. Of all the creatures living in the water, you may eat any that has fins and scales. But anything that does not have fins and scales, you may not eat, for you it is unclean. So only those creatures in the water that have both fins and scales are fit to eat. In other words, the fish, in other words. Whales, sharks, porpoises, sturgeon, eels, crabs, clams, lobsters, oysters, crawfish, frogs, shrimp, mussels, and so on, do not have one or the other, or in most cases, both. They lack both fins and scales. Now, many of these, as the Jameson, Fawcett, Brown commentary mentioned, pass on gastrointestinal infection, plus hepatitis, plus typhoid fever, and other problems. Periodically, and this was true here in our area last summer, warnings are published, posted, don't eat the shellfish because of the red tide. Red tide is caused by a little plankton that is poisonous to humans, but not to shellfish. When we went fishing up at Whidbey Island last summer, sign going down the trail on the beach, don't eat the shellfish. When we went to Victoria, went out along the coast, along one of the beaches there, big sign there, don't eat the shellfish because of the red tide. Oysters, for example, concentrate in their flesh pollutants at a level 70,000 times higher than the pollutant level in the surrounding air, water that they live in. That's what they're for, is to filter the pollutants and the poisonous material out of the water in clams and mussels and that. Of course, crabs eat on all the dead bodies that fall, you know, end up on the bottom of the ocean floor, including humans and that type of thing. That's known fact. These things, especially the shellfish, are scavengers and are underwater garbage cans. And that's why you can pick up the hepatitis and the typhoid fever and those types of infections from them, because they're there to filter that stuff out of the water. Now, tuna fish are clean. Sometimes there's questions about that. Some tuna fish are not completely covered with scales. They have scales behind their gill plates. It doesn't say they have to be covered. It says scales and fins. There's another type of fish that really is a mackerel family that are sold as tuna fish that look like they have skin. But if you look at them, they have very microscopic scales. They do have scales, but they're very tiny. You just have to look close. And that type of thing. But of the clean fish, like cod and mackerel and snapper, that type of thing, the white-fleshed ones, these fish are low in fat, high in trace minerals and iodine, are extremely good protein sources, and are easier to digest than animal flesh is. Very good sources of food. Right, verse 11 and 12. That you may eat any clean bird. Doesn't specifically say which, but we'll see what the hint is here. But those you may not eat, the eagle, the vulture, the black vulture, the red kite, the black kite, any kind of falcon, any kind of raven, horned owl, screech owl, the gull, any kind of hawk, the little owl, great owl, white owl, desert owl, osprey, cormorant, stork, any kind of heron. The hoopoe was a mid-eastern carrion eater type of bird, and the bat. Now, basically, clean birds are the birds like the pigeon, the dove, which were offered in sacrifice. And the quail, grouse. Remember, God fed the people of Israel with these birds when they were crying, "We want flesh to eat." And they came out of Egypt. Pheasant, chicken, turkey, duck, goose, birds that have both a craw and a gizzard are the type of birds that are clean to eat. The unclean birds are, again, the scavengers and the carrion eaters. And they have an entirely different digestive system. And it doesn't take the garbage and the toxin and the poison out of the material they eat. So or the clean birds have a digestive system that do. And then the goodies, verse 19 and 20. All flying insects that swarm are unclean to you. Do not eat them. But any winged creature that is clean, you may eat. Now, Leviticus 11 says that the insects that are clean to eat, really not, maybe I shouldn't say technically, but they are clean to eat, are the grasshopper and the locust. Now, the Bible says those are edible. And people in the Mideast area have and do eat them. Now, as for me, I'd rather not. Now, if I was starving to death and that's all I had, I bet I'd give it a whirl. Now, they really, locusts, they take their head, turn it half, a quarter of a turn, pull its head, and it cleans the locust. That's how they clean it. Then they fry in an oil. But I don't hope I pass on that. I think I'll live just as long. Then verse 21, he concludes here by saying, do not eat anything you find already dead. You may give it to an alien living in any of your towns, and he may eat it, or you may sell it to a foreigner, but you are a holy people to the Lord your God. Do not cook a young goat in its mother's mouth. Now, in most nations today, this is a law. Sick or dead animals, animals that die to themselves, cannot be sold for food. You know, that even society recognizes the reasons for that. Because they're diseased, they're full of poison, they're both toxins and so on as a result of death, and they haven't been bled. Now, the prohibition against cooking a kid in its mother's milk is a religious prohibition. The pagans of that time, at the end of the harvest, would boil a kid in its mother's milk, and they would sprinkle that broth as a magical potion on their gardens and fields as a means of entreating their pagan gods to give them a good crop next year. See, that's idolatry. And that's why God says don't do that type of thing. So far, though, we've seen that God says don't eat fat, don't eat blood, don't eat those creatures designated as unclean. The reason he says that is because of their nature and purpose. They're scavengers, they're garbage disposal, their flesh is full of parasites, garbage, poison, toxins, and that type of thing. It's not fit for human consumption or health. And that's why God says, don't do it. So he tells us what's good and what isn't good in that regard. All right, let's go on to Daniel chapter 1. Daniel lived in a society that had polluted much of what should have been fit to eat, but really wasn't, much like our society today. Now, as Dr. Mendelsohn said, as we read, we have to eat and drink pure food and water. And that's the second law of good health, is to eat good, pure food and water. Now, Daniel knew that too. Let's read his example here, Daniel chapter 1, beginning in verse 3. Said, then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Of course, Daniel had been taken captive and carried captive off to Babylon, and this is talking about him and his friends. Excuse me. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. So these people were to be fed, and this included Daniel, as we'll see, from the king's table. Presumably, that was the best food in the nation of Babylon. He ate the best. That's verse 6 through 8. And among these were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and the chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. Of course, these were the three that were thrown in the fiery furnace. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now, Daniel didn't think that that was the best food, the king's food in the world, did he? Didn't do it. And so Daniel asked permission not to eat of that food. And it goes on here. Verse 9. Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse and or punier, sicker, weaker than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. In other words, he'd literally chop his head off. And Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servant for 10 days. Give us nothing but bowls, or pulse, as it says in the King James, and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them the 10 days. Now the Hebrew word for pulse or vegetables in verse 12 is any vegetable thing grown from seed. That would include the grains, the legumes like beans and lentils, vegetables, both root and leafy, melons, all kinds of things. But they were grown from seed. In verse 15 and 16, it goes on to say, and at the end of 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. So Daniel followed that particular diet. And after 10 days of eating these vegetables, including what we would probably call some fruits too, and the natural grains, he was healthier than those eating the king's special, refined, sweetened, spiced up goodies. Some commentaries think that eating these things raw is implied here too, though it doesn't say that specifically. Now, do you know that it was the world's so-called royalty who first started refining grains in the white flour? You know why they did that? They were the ones that did it. Because the royalty didn't want to have to eat that same old coarse brown bread that the peasants ate. So they started making the white flour nice and pretty. Now, white sugar, as we know it, was developed by Napoleon for the purpose of war as a concentrated food to feed his troops. He's the one that really started the refining of the sugar beet and making the white sugar as we know it today. Now, when grain, sugar beet, sugar cane is refined to make it white, all the vitamins, all the minerals, all of the bulk or bran is stripped from it. 90% of rats fed on today's enriched white bread will die of malnutrition within 90 days. Because there isn't enough nutrition there to keep them alive in that stuff. And that includes all the frosty flakes, nice breakfast food. You know, I think there was a gal here a couple of years ago in Vancouver did a test. You know, as part of her biology class, she fed these mice on the great breakfast foods, and pretty quick their little toesies were sticking up in the air. They didn't last very long. As I mentioned, these refined foods have the bulk stripped away from them. They don't pass through your intestines properly. They just gum up. Take some of that Wonder Bread and you know, just squeeze it and see what you end up with. And you wonder how in the world that would ever get through your intestines. But that's what happens. It gets plugged up down there. Then it putrefies. The toxins that result from that then cause bowel cancer, which is one of the leading causes of cancer in this country, because of lack of bulk. Now, white flour and white sugar are probably the worst two things that you can eat. And yet, what do we do with them? We take them and we mix them together, the white flour and the white sugar, and we make all of our good, gooey pastries and cakes and cookies and all that that taste so good. But kill us. One thing, it makes death pleasant, doesn't it? Not really. You know, and even pasteurized and homogenized milk is a highly refined food and very hard to digest. Pellagra, which is a disease of the skin and you break out in the skin and you have digestive disorders was caused by milling all the B vitamins out of grain. And that's why they had to begin to put some of them back in what we call so-called enriched flour, to keep people from coming down with pellagra. Didn't realize that for a while. Of course, the vitamin E is all stripped out of the grain, which helps keep your heart and blood vessels healthy. Plus, there are processed foods are all, you know, burdened down, loaded up with non-food preservatives, which are really poisons. Bread is full of emulsifiers, thickeners, often a byproduct of pulp mills. You know how good a pulp mill smells. Well, after that's gone through the process, they take some of the cellulose, really sawdust, and put it in bread as a thickener. Good stuff. Then they take some of that liquor and make imitation vanilla out of it. That's where your imitation vanilla comes from. And there's buffers and neutralizers and flavorings and coloring, of which some, if not all, cause cancer. Well, I'm sure that the food that Daniel stayed away from was far better than the refined and processed junk food that we have, you know, so readily available today. That if Daniel lived today, he wouldn't even walk in one of our supermarkets, let alone eat much that comes out of it. Now, during World War II, the British people could not get sugar. In fact, we had a hard time getting it here. And by law, their flour had to be 85% whole wheat. And in spite of some of the other shortages of what would be good food, they were healthier at the end of World War II than they were at the beginning of it. Because they couldn't get their hands on junk food. Even though they weren't even eating an adequate diet, at least they weren't tearing their health down with the junk food. That was true in Denmark in World War I. That type of thing. You know, Proverbs 25:27 says to eat honey, a natural sweetener, the best there is, only sparingly. In Proverbs 25:27. In that regard. Now, we ought to eat a lot more fresh vegetables, both leafy and root types. Eat more of them raw or lightly cooked for the needed bulk that keep our bowels clean and help prevent cancer and that type of thing. Now, the Chinese really know how to cook vegetables, I think. You know, they just get them nice and hot. They're still pretty crispy and so on. And we ought to eat a lot more whole grain cereals and bread. Now, frozen vegetables are better than fresh, or I should say next best to fresh. Canned vegetables come along a very poor third behind them as far as their nutritional quality. Most canned fruits are embalmed in sugar. And now, there are many good books on nutrition, natural nutrition, that type of thing. You ought to get one to study it. Now, this, I feel, is primarily a wife's responsibility to look after the health of the family. As being a good keeper at home, she's the one that fixes the meals and that type of thing. We ought to cut out a lot more of the heavy fat meats like hamburger, eat more lean fish, chicken, turkey, that type of thing. Goat meat is very good, very lean. Unpasteurized cheeses, yogurts, that type of thing are good food too. You know, you can get books that will give you very basic information on that. All right, Mark chapter 2, verse 18 through 20, speaks of another health major. And that is fasting. Now, Mark chapter 2 primarily is talking about fasting for spiritual reasons. But he does mention it. There's two benefits as far as fasting is concerned. If I can find Mark chapter 2. Verse 18 through 20. It said, now John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. Some people came and asked Jesus, how is it that John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees are fasting, but yours are not? Jesus answered, how can the guests of the bridegroom fast while he is with them? They cannot.